Hey, it's Matt. Real quick, I hope I'm not breaking this news to you. I hope you've heard already, but Marion O. Smith died yesterday. I'm down here recording this. I had this all ready to go, but I can't start this podcast without acknowledging it. And this one's really hard for me, too, because, I mean, I didn't know him or anything. I didn't. I met him a couple of times, but I really wanted him for this podcast. And everyone kept saying, you know, you ought to get Marion. You ought to get Marion. And I never did. And now I never will. And it sucks. Not because I didn't get him for the podcast. It sucks that he's gone in general. A wealth of knowledge and stories. And again, I didn't even know him, but I wish I could have gotten to know him. And if you were close to him, I'm sorry for your loss. But anyway, I'm going to dedicate this episode to him. All right. This podcast is sponsored by Sophie Reaptress. She makes cave suits. She makes awesome cave suits. She'll even put a bat stencil wherever you want. You want a tramp stamp bat stencil? She put one right there, but I don't know. She's a one-person business based in Philadelphia. She started making leggings. She's a wizard with the sewing machine, and she's expanded from leggings over the years. She makes all kinds of stuff now. She started making cave suits because she didn't see a lot to choose from out there, so she started to make her own, and she makes them with 500 denier cordura around the suit, all over the suit, and then 1,000 denier cordura, twice as thick where you need it, elbows, butts, knees, wherever you need more reinforcement. A lot of colors to choose from. They start from basic suits, and then she'll do add-ons to order, like extra pockets, inside pockets, knee pad pockets, just slip the pads right in there. And like I said, the bat stencils. Everything's made to order just for you, and you can find her on Instagram at Sophie Reaptress and at SophieReaptress.com. I will put a link in the description of this podcast so you can order from her. She makes such great cave suits. If you've thought about getting a cave suit and you're not sure what to get one from Sophie and get exactly what you want. Welcome to the Caving Podcast. My name is Matt Pelser. I am a member of the Central Indiana Grotto, former chairman. And a grotto is like a club, caving club. And we are organized for a reason, because caving's like a lot of things. It's really safe if you know what you're doing. And if you don't, if it's your first time and you're going for the first time and you don't know what to expect, I mean, it can be really unsafe, and you can, you know, go in unprepared. You can get lost. Any number of bad things can happen. Just ask anyone who's gone into a cave with not enough light or not enough gear and has, you know, gotten stuck. It's cavers that come in to rescue them. So don't make the mistake of going in unprepared. Find your local grotto. You don't have to join right away. Maybe just go on a few trips with them and see if it's for you, because you might find out that it's not. But if it is, they'd love to have you. And I'll put a link in the description of this podcast so you can find your local grotto. Or if you want to find it yourself, you can go to caves.org, the National Speleological Society website. Pretty easy to remember, caves.org, and it's a great-looking new website. You should check it out. Great guest this month in Chad McCain from Missouri. Just incredible stories and a great storyteller, too, and just a really, really impressive caver. I can't wait for you to hear it. Haven't been caving this past month. Not really a whole lot in the outdoor world either. I need to change that. I did do a little bit of hiking, but not nearly as much as I did in October. So maybe at the new year, I'll have a little more to report. But one thing I would like for you to think about is coming to the Winter Adventure Weekend at Carter Cave State Resort Park in Kentucky. I am delivering the keynote speech on Saturday night, and it's just such a great weekend of caving and all kinds of stuff. Sure, cave-related, but other things too. Really just adventure-related. And I'd love to meet you. Maybe we could go caving together. And I'd love for you to be there for the presentation on Saturday night. If you've heard one of my grotto presentations, it's going to be kind of like that, but I'm going to have multimedia. I'm going to have some photos and some newer clips, some different clips. I'm going to try to put them in like a certain order to give the thing an arc, you know. Really excited for you to see this thing and present on all of this great oral history that I've gotten since I started doing the podcast 6 years ago. So, yeah, I'll see you at Carter Cave State Resort Park on the last weekend in January, January the 26th through the 29th at Carter Cave State Resort Park. And I got a link in the description of this podcast where you can register and find more details. All right, let's get to it. Chad McCain was so forthcoming with his stories and generous with his time. In fact, I'll go ahead and share this. I don't have to, I guess, but the day that we had set this up, we got our wires crossed on time, and he kind of showed up at a moment's notice and just did the thing. And it still sounded this good. Like, the guy is just a great storyteller. And if you know him, you probably know that already, but this was my first time meeting him. I heard about Chad, hadn't talked to him yet except for emails. And what amazing stories. And there's one toward the end that was harrowing. Maybe, I don't want to say the most harrowing story that I've ever heard on the podcast, but it's up there. It's got to be top five. So without any further ado, here is me and Chad McCain. So you got an OCR coming up this weekend?
Yeah, so our last OCR was 10 years ago, and we have a
just
really
like in the area there?
Yeah, kind of. It's about an hour south of my house down in Perry County. Perry County is kind of the cave capital of Missouri, and I say that in the standpoint, there's not necessarily the most caves anymore because the guys that are working hard in the Ozarks, they've surpassed the cave count of Perry County, but it still has four of the five longest caves in the state and then a dozen that are 3 miles to 1 mile long. You know, so it's just big caves all over the place. And that's where I lived. I moved to Missouri, gosh, I guess it was 15 years ago. And the neighbors were like, oh, you know, there's caves near here. I'm like, what? Where? You know, like any sinkhole, you know, take a pick, just start jumping in holes, right? And that's kind of how I got started. But anyway, we have a 24.5 mile long property that the or cave that the Missouri Cave and Karst Conservancy owns the entrance of, or one of the entrances anyway. And we have about an acre there and a campground. Of course, it's big, easy going cave right around the entrance. So 10 years ago, we had an OCR, and it's been a decade. So, or maybe it was 8 years ago. It really doesn't matter. It's been a while. So I contacted Jess, and yeah, they're coming over this weekend. We have, I think, 60 participants signed up for it. So should be a good time.
That's a pretty good number. You mean Jess Deli?
Yeah, Jess Deli.
Yeah. 60 is not bad. You got an enthusiastic caving community there, it seems. I've talked to a few Missouri people.
Yeah, I've been affiliated with the SEMO Grotto ever since I got started because I lived in Perryville, and that's where the SEMO Grotto was based out of. And, you know, we've kind of been struggling, gosh, ever since I got started 14 years ago. But, you know, we have a local guy who got involved, and he's really bringing in new people and got a lot of enthusiasm. I mean, we had the same cave we're having the OCR at, we had a dive trip with Mike Young, the cave diver.
Mm-hmm.
He set that, what is it, the depth record at Roaring River State Park or whatever that spring is in southwest Missouri. Anyway, we had him in the same cave we're having the OCR at a couple months ago because we're trying to connect that cave to another mile-long cave. The dive wasn't successful. But, you know, we come out from hauling all his dive gear out, and everybody's like, hey, did you guys hear about the dog rescue? And we're like, what? And there was a dog found in the cave, which hit national news. You probably heard about it. I mean, it was everywhere. And anyway, on that dive trip, we had six gals that were involved in between the ages of 18 and 26 hauling dive gear.
Wow.
And they're all newer cavers and local. And it was like, gosh, you know, this will be kind of a tough trip. You want in on it? And they're like, yeah. So, you know, they're definitely enthusiastic about it. So we had, gosh, I don't know, the SEMO Grotto, it's definitely been growing, and it's a lot of locals, and it's amazing because most of them, you know, they don't even know the caves are there, or at least they don't know how big they are.
When did caving start for you?
Right around, 14 years and 4 months ago.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it was right when you moved into the area?
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty much. There was about, I don't know, 6 or 8 months there where I knew other stuff. Like I hiked in the area, and there was rock climbing in Southern Illinois that was a couple hours away. And my wife and I, we were doing that kind of stuff. And then we heard about the caving, and then the grotto at the time had a, they kind of had a program with the Missouri Department of Conservation where we could use their facility in Cape Girardeau for meetings, and then they would lead like a beginner's trip once a year. So my wife and I jumped in on that, went on the cave trip, met the guys, and apparently, you know, we weren't terrible because we got invited, you know, to go caving again the next weekend. And that's when we, that's when they invited us, you know, to go to the project cave that they had just found, which ended up, you know, being a fairly large cave. I mean, it was already a big cave at the time, but, you know, so got involved really surveying within, I don't know, two or three trips.
So a couple of tourist trips to start off and then just survey ever since.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, you know, I with these new group, you know, I get it. Not everybody wants to survey, and they want to see stuff. They want to see cool stuff. So yeah, we've been, this year I've probably surveyed the least amount in a long time anyway, just because I've been trying to do more with taking these younger people or just newer cavers in general, just to places that even I haven't been in 5 or 10 years, just because all I do is go mapping. And, you know, I get it. Not everybody wants to do an 8 or 10 or 12 hour trip, you know, surveying and freezing your ass off and being miserable. So I've been trying to, you know, help at least take people to the more, you know, inaccessible places that I do have access to. So far it's working, but, you know, it's kind of given me a break from drawing maps, which very needed.
Yeah, but you know what? Sometimes you need a recharge, you know, before you get back into that.
Yeah, that's kind of how it's been. Because I mean, I've been earlier this year, I got caught up on the Moore Cave system, which right now is it's the same one where we're having the OCR, the one the MCKC owns. You know, it's a 24.5 mile long cave right now. And when the MCKC bought the cave 11 years ago, the CRF and the MSS, which is the Missouri Speological Survey, they kind of made an agreement to start remapping the cave because the old map was trash. The data was trash. There was no way to pick up where they left off without just starting over. So they started over. And as of now, I don't even know what the total is now. It's been a while since I looked, but it's over 18 miles, approaching 19 of either resurvey or new survey. And considering the cave was 18 miles long historically, we've mapped that much new, but the cave is 24.5 miles long now. We've added a lot of stuff that was just never done. But you know how it is. Back in the day, they were using what they had, and now we have a Disto X that you can survey anything with that. No matter how terrible it is, you can easily survey through a crawlway. You know, where back in the day, they weren't doing that. But anyway, I'm the only cartographer on it, and I've got, I don't know, 16 of the miles of it drawn. The map is like 24 feet tall by 8 feet wide. It's ridiculously huge printed out, and it's just me. So yeah, I needed a break from that. So we're still mapping in there. I'm just kind of, I'll get the map cut off when I get to it, you know, and probably next year I'll probably do another draft every night after work for a month and get it caught up, which is usually what I do now.
Have you tried to get other people in to cartography to help out?
Not on that project, but I've definitely helped those who have shown an interest in cartography drawing other maps, because, you know, if we're cranking out small cave maps right and left down there, well, I can't draw them all. It's like, here, you need to learn how to do it. And some people have, so it's definitely taken a load off, because there for a while, yeah, if we mapped a small cave, it's like, all right, give me the notes. I'll get to it when I can.
Is there a way, would you say, to characterize the caves of Missouri? Like when people talk about Indiana, where I'm at, you know, they say, oh, it's a lot of mud. It's a lot of crawling. And I mean, I'll cop to that, I guess. And then down in Tagg, it's a little more roomy, a little more vertical element. Yeah. How would you characterize the caves of Missouri if you could boil it down, or would you even want to?
Well, that's definitely an interesting question. Where I cave at, it's a sinkhole plain. So those caves are completely different than when you hear of like the Ozark caves. The big Ozark caves, their characteristics, I mean, the bedrock is completely different. The ones I've been in, I mean, it's usually the the Ruby Dew, which is a very rotten rock. I mean, if you were to do a bolt climb in a Ruby Dew formation cave, you'd need bolts that are, I mean, huge, because the outer, you know what I mean? The outer 6 to 8 inches of the cave is just going to peel off.
Right.
And you put an expansion bolt in, the whole wall just blows out. So, you know, that doesn't happen there. But, you know, recently we did a trip into Carroll Cave, which is the third longest cave in the state. It's 22 miles long, I think, if I remember right. And we just eclipsed 22 miles on the trip. But there was a dome that I really wanted to climb. But one of the guys was like, you know what, why don't I fly a drone up there first and see if, and so we did. And he, of course, flew it up there and there was nothing. So not worth the risk. I mean, it was a 70-foot dome. It would have been suicide. It really would have been. But the point is, you know, those caves are usually heavily decorated, very muddy, red Ozark clay. A lot of signs of life from, well, you know, bear beds, claw marks, just all over the place, you mm-hmm. know, in those Ozark caves. And, you know, the Ozark cave that I've been into in Arkansas, which I've helped map and fit in, which, if I'm not mistaken, is the longest cave in Arkansas, down on the Buffalo River area. And it kind of still has that same characteristic of, you know, it's huge cave. Really big cave, but red clay and bear beds and formations, where the sinkhole plain caves, where I do most of my caving, mainly because it's just an hour away. And I used to live there. Like, I live in St. Louis now, but when I lived in Perryville, all these 20, 30 mile long caves were minutes from my house. So, you know, I made relationships with the landowners, so I that's where I still go. But they're a lot more muddy because it's a lot more row cropping, you know, farm fields, cow pastures, and all that runoff into the cave. And you got these huge mud banks that aren't clay, but soil, you know, field runoff. You know, one of the guys that I know here in town, Aaron Addison, he made a comment to me, you know, several years ago. He's like, you know, before row cropping happened, these caves all probably looked completely different, meaning they weren't filled in with mud. And now, you know, it's like, yeah, that's probably right. So 200 years of farm runoff, it'll fill even the big caves up to an extent. But the caves in Perry County, there's a couple that are heavily decorated, but not many. You know, so the big caves, they're just big. St. Genevieve County, where I do a lot of caving at, that's where the Black Fathom River Cave was found. That's a little over seven miles. That's where I found the Geg Cave, which is 4¾ miles long. The Black Fathom River Cave is more decorated than any cave that I've seen in Missouri. Now, granted, I haven't been in all these obscure, out of the way Ozark caves like the guys in the local grotto here in St. Louis have been. But I mean, the Black Fathom, I mean, you get into it and it's just decorated start to finish, all seven miles, even in a crappy crawlway. There's just stuff everywhere. I guess it's because it's in the Salem limestone, which not a lot of caves in that area are. And it's very, you know, it's a decorated cave. Geg Cave, which again, it's the second longest cave in St. Genevieve. Gosh, I think right now it's the 10th or 11th or 12th longest in Missouri. And I don't really know all this because, again, it's like, oh, we got to get this cave longer than the next cave. You know how it is when you're a surveyor. That's like the goal, past the next cave. It's just a maze cave. It's an anomaly right off Interstate 55 and not really that decorated. It does have some, but it's, again, heavily mud-filled in areas, but a complete joint-controlled maze unlike anything else. I mean, at one time, before we actually had a stream breakout that actually traveled a distance away, the cave was something like 3 or 3.5 miles long, and it was all contained in 1,000 by 1,200 feet. and you know, it was, and it's a fun cave, you know. It's a sporty, but just like anything, and, you know, I haven't caved in Indiana, but I do know there are sinkhole plains in that area. I've heard, you know, like the people being trapped in the flood in Binkley's cave. I know Joe Kinder was on that trip. And we talked about it at Tag, you know, at the Tag Fall Cave in a few years ago, and it was like, wow, blow my mind. And then of course I'm in this Geg cave, and there there was a 30% chance of 0.03 inch of rain. And I'm in there surveying maybe 600 feet from the entrance. And then all of a sudden it just sounded like a fire hydrant was turned on.
Oh God.
And we look down, we're up in an upper level, like trunk line, and we're looking down at the stream level, and it's like, what is that noise? The water, it looks fine. And it just kept getting louder and louder and louder. And it finally, this was before I had a Disto X. So we had the tape strung all over the place. It's like, okay, we need to get out of here. Wadded up the tape, shoved everything in the cave packs and took off. And sure enough, there's this little dome in the ceiling on the main stream. And forever we'd walk past it. Everything is covered in mud except for the bottom, where it's just clean washed bedrock. And we're like, I wonder why that is. Well, we get to it and it's like a column of water, 5 feet wide, just, you know, muddy water. And it's like, holy crap, we have got to get out of here. And again, we're not that far in, but you see that and it's like, okay, this is serious. So we get out of the mainstream and we're crawling through the crawlway to get out, and muddy water starting to flow through that. And it's like, oh boy, this is not good. And the entrance itself is an interesting entrance, because on the topo map, it's a sinkhole pond. Blue circle, it's a pond, but the whole thing dropped out. The pond is long gone.
Oh my God.
And, you know, it literally is one of those spots where when you're in the entrance area, you can see all the folded rock and how it's collapsed in and packed in with clay. And then here's this entrance we're able to go through the breakdown, and we get to it, and it's just a solid wall of water. Just, you know, there's no way out. And finally, it was scary, of course, but it was climbable. And I finally made the decision. It's like, all right, I'm getting rid of my cave pack. I'm getting out of here. I'm not dying in here today. And so I climbed out through the breakdown. And of course, you know, when you're climbing through that water, you have to look down so you can breathe. And I got outside and it was raining like hell. And I waited on the other two guys to come out and they never followed. I'm like, oh, so I had to go back in and get them. And finally we all got out, and then the rain stopped, and I immediately loaded up the radar, and there was just this red blob that just kind of formed right on top of the cave and then slowly moved away. It dumped about an inch of rain in 20 minutes. And there's been some junk that we've seen in the cave, like little plastic stuff, because again, sinkhole plain, there's the highways, stuff ends up in the cave, right? Well, there was this little like pink elephant, like Happy Meal toy that I had stuck to the wall that we found in the area we were surveying. And we went back the next time, that pink elephant was now at the entrance where we'd climbed out of. So that whole cave flooded to the ceiling. Wow. With just that quick flash, So yeah, scary as hell, but you know, that's the danger that we have, as you know, mapping in sinkhole plain caves, is every bit of water goes underground. And, you know, we always watch the weather, but who would have thought 0.03 inch of rain, 30%, you're fine. Not that day. So,
I mean, so I talked to the people who, a few of the people who are involved with that rescue, either in the cave, stuck in the cave, or outside the cave. And so many of them have now changed the way they do it because of that incident. Again, it was like a 20 or 30% chance. No, it wasn't even 30. It was like a 20% chance that day.
Right.
Barely enough to be on like the Apple weather, you know, on your iPhone.
Right.
And yet it still came and it still happened. And part of the issue was that the ground was frozen, so nothing soaked in and it went right into the cave. Did that incident change the way you've approached things?
Kind of, because I think if I remember right, when we were mapping Black Fathom, and again, I got in on that project early. It was like 1.7 miles long when I got involved.
Wow.
And now it's 7.13, and any leads left are horrible, terrible, but it was a river. It is a river cave. And, you know, there's a place called the wind tunnel. When all we knew of one entrance, you had to go through the wind tunnel, which you were swimming. You couldn't touch the ground. You couldn't touch the bottom of the cave. You're literally swimming through it. And there was just enough of an airspace to swim through with your head, not an ear dipper, but just a perfect like little channel. And if the cave would have rose, 8 inches while you were in it, you'd have been trapped. If I remember right, our rule was 20% rain, or we call it off. If it's over 20, and of course I went into to the Geg cave with 30% chance of rain, but it wasn't 30% of 2 inches. It was 3/100 of an inch. Well, lesson learned. So yeah, I mean, if it's 30%, I mean, again, depending on the cave. Yeah, if it's 20%, that's kind of the cutoff. We never had a close call in Black Fathom ever. And we surveyed that cave hard for 2.5 years. And then off and on, you know, ever since we kind of got the bulk of the cave done. We've done trips in other caves during snow melt. We actually tried to do a trip into Black Fathom during a snow melt. The water was just, I mean, alpine cold.
Right. You
know, like if we would have tried to do what we were doing, there would have been either many fatalities or many cases of hypothermia and probably still be in there today. You know, I mean, it was frigidly cold and, you know, you're just in the water so much then, but I was used to it, but even I got cold, you know. I mean, again, after that first like little tourist trip or two or five or whatever it was, you know, for me, it was wetsuit survey every weekend, just wetsuit survey. That's all I knew was wet caving, and it didn't bother me. But that day I was like, okay, this is cold. So that flood event is the only one that I can think of that really scared the hell out of me. But recently we were down in Arkansas mapping a cave in the national forest, and it was a joint controlled cave, and there were cracks, of course, in the ceiling where if I remember right, we were obviously in the limestone, but if I remember right, the ceiling was a sandstone cap or something. I don't remember, but there were cracks all the way through it. About 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we had just finished up our objective and water started pouring in everywhere. And so, of course, I'm having flashbacks of, oh my God, we got to get the hell out of here. But we were at the top of the ridge. There was very little watershed above us. So it really didn't matter how hard it rained. The cave wasn't going to flood. But mentally, it's definitely affected me, because when I'm in like low air, just you hear a noise and you're like, oh God, is it raining outside? And that's, you know, it's just your mind plays tricks on you after something like that. And I haven't really talked to Joe Kinder, who was on the Binkley flood trap, whatever you want to call it, rescue. But I wonder if that happened to any of them, where, you know, now they hear the, you know, those noises in the wet caves. And does it bother you? Because a lot of the caving I do, it's all recharged areas that can flood. And if it's the wrong day, then.
Yeah, I don't want to speak for any of them, but I did have Marion Akers on, and yeah, I mean, she takes a lot of extra precautions now, and when she hears anything or sees anything on the forecast, yeah, it's over.
You know, my biggest concern isn't like the big storm front moving through, like what just happened. I don't know if you got the rain yesterday. I'm sure you did.
Oh yeah,
but we finally had a big storm front move through. And now I'm, you know, looking outside and it's blue skies. And I've done trips in Perry County in the big caves where that big storm cell moved in and it was out of the area by 7 a.m. And we went in the cave at 9 a.m. and did a big multi-mile long going downstream. And, of course, there's water pouring in from all different places. And we're like, oh, this is so cool. But the forecast was like completely clear. The big storm front moved through. But now it seems like in the past 5 years, we keep getting these storm cells that just pop up out of nothing and then dump feet, you know, of rain. It seems like God, before this drought set in, you know, there was a storm cell that moved in North St. Louis. They got 13 inches of rain in a couple hours. And you look at all the river gauges on the water government website with all the water stuff. I look at it all the time and look at the water gauges, and it went from like, you know, 2 feet to 38, just with a line going straight up. And it's like, you know, if that ever happens to us, what do you do?
Yeah.
Because, yeah, there are high and dry areas in these caves, but my God, I haven't been trapped in one yet. So I'm kind of knock on wood.
No kidding. So back to the sinkhole plain then. With all that soil in there, how much digging happens, and do you find anything?
Yeah, we've like in Black Fathom, we've dug on stuff here and there. We haven't opened up anything substantial there other than like getting into areas that it's like, okay, we know there's something up there which sounds weird. Like there was this chute that I climbed up a joint canyon in a formation area. And I got to the top of it where it belled out and you could see like 2 inches over a mud bank. And of course you're 38 feet above the floor at that time. You're like, why is there a mud bank right here? Well, it's obviously a very, very old, you know, clay fill or whatever it was. And yeah. Could feel airflow coming through it. And of course, got my garden trowel out because back in the day, you know, when it's those virgin survey trips, we always had digging tools because you never know, which is really funny. But because I had a friend who always said, why take a garden trowel? You're never going to be able to dig anything on just one trip with a garden trowel and then get into it. It's like, okay, so whatever. Well, that day again, dug in and it led to this massive formation room, not like necessarily going passage, but just this crazy huge formation room. And it was like, okay, that was cool. But back in the other cave, the one that almost flooded me in, the Geg cave, the almost the 5 miler. So we were mapping along one day with this guy who said, why bring a garden trowel? I'll even call him out by name. It was Michael Bradford. I've surveyed tons of cave with him. Him and I discovered the major breakout on Thanksgiving Day. I think it was 6 or 7 years ago that made this cave go from just a crappy crawling cave to holy crap, it's 30 feet tall and 20 feet wide and going every direction, right?
Wow.
So we're surveying an upper level that we found that's in this same area. And again, he was like, why bring a garden trowel? There's no point. You're never going to dig into anything, right? So we survey to the end of this passage and we're there and him and this gal are talking and they wouldn't shut up, of course, because they're just, you know, they're on point. They've got the distos. I'm drawing everything. When they get up there, I'm like, well, what's going on here? Oh, well, the cave continues that way, but it's, you know, yay tall. And of course, you know, being the sketcher, I shove myself up in there just to draw everything in. And they finally quit talking. I'm like, dude, I can hear water up ahead. And he's like, what? I'm like, yeah, I can hear water. And so I back out and he's smaller than me. I'm 6'2½, right around 190 pounds or 195 pounds, sometimes 200, I guess, depends on the day. But anyway, he's like I think he's 5'8", maybe 5'6", and very slim, right? So he can fit places I cannot. He sticks his head in there and he's like, oh my God, I do hear water. And he's trying to get through. And keep in mind, the passage is probably 6 feet wide, 8 to 6 inches tall. And he's like, give me that garden trowel. I'm like, yeah, that's what I thought. Right. So he's able to dig through a low spot and get to a bigger spot and then repeat and repeat. And finally he's going. And he belly crawled probably 80 feet in a chest compressor. That's just mud floor, you know? So if he would have gotten stuck, we could have got him out eventually.
Right.
I heard him, you know, he's like, oh my God, I just intersected a trunk line and there's another stream. And oh, you know, every bit of this cave was virgin everything. So every round the corner, it was always a new discovery. And this was no different, you know, and I had the GoPro recording and of course you couldn't see it, but you could hear him on it. And he's like splashing around in the water and oh my God, it's, you know, he's just going crazy, which is kind of funny because we'd found so much of that. But to get to that point, we were in a mainstream and we had to climb up to the ceiling into an overflow route. And then he dropped into another parallel, well, not even a parallel stream, but just another stream. So you could say it's a drainage divide, but I don't think it is because I think eventually the streams, they do meet up, you know. But at the time, it's like, oh, my God, we just crossed a drainage divide. What did we get into? We actually ended up finding another entrance up that way, which is terrible, terrible stuff. But, yeah, the mud fill, we've dug a lot. And sometimes it just goes to nothing, or like this time it unlocked another, oh, I don't know, quarter mile of cave and another entrance. Yeah. So if the role would have been reversed, if we would have come in from that crappy entrance and found that clay filled tunnel and nobody could fit through it, it would have been kind of one of those deals where are you ever even going to really dig on it? Because you can't hear anything that way. But because we were coming the other way and we could hear that stream, dig on it, you know.
Absolutely.
But I mean, at the end of the day, yeah, you send somebody in there that's small, they could have pushed it without even digging anything. Like some of those gals that have come around. The funny thing is, so back to the SEMO grotto with these newer people that are coming in, all the gals, they're all between 4'10" and 5'3" and tiny. And the one gal that lives up here by me, I mean, she's got no fear. I mean, she she will push stuff. And I'm like, God, I hope you don't get stuck because I cannot come get you, you know.
Very, very cool to have those people just show up and start doing stuff, you know?
Yeah, it is. You know, there's other digging methods that we've obviously done that, you know, I'm sure everybody does these days, which have definitely unlocked lots of cave, you know, removing bedrock and whatnot. We've definitely found a lot doing so, every method. But yeah, the easy way, just the digging with a garden trowel or that's usually what we take. You know, I know when Anmar came and did our last OCR in Perry County, he said he was always a fan of taking a flat bar everywhere because you can push it and twist it. And I'm like, yeah, that's a good idea. But gosh, those are heavy.
Yeah.
You know, garden trowels made of aluminum, they weigh fractions of the weight of a steel flat bar. But, you know, I guess if you got a new person who's fit here, take the digging tools, you know.
Do you think that the beauty of Black Fathom River Cave, since that was kind of where you started survey, do you think that how pretty that one is kind of helped hook you on it? Or was it just the activity?
With that one, like, I've always been an explorer, for lack of a better term. You know, I was one of those kids always riding my bike down the gravel roads. And of course, that was 35 years ago. We didn't have Google Maps. You didn't even have a paper map with the county road. So it's just like ride out until you run out of water and come home dehydrated and find an old barn and explore the barn and, you know, whatever. I guess then it was more of the adventure level because we were actually taking canoes into the cave and floating the first 1,000 feet.
Cool.
And then getting out and then swimming. And then it's low air, you know, big passage, crawling, floating. Plus, this is something I haven't mentioned, but Black Fathom used to be loaded with catfish and carp that were 2 to 3 feet long. So when these guys were exploring in the initial survey, right, where the guys in the Seymour Grotto found the cave, they could either go upstream or they could go downstream. Well, downstream, other than 10 feet of crawling, opened right up into easy walking, heavily decorated, and went that way for a half mile. A couple spots of deeper water, but just basically walking, where upstream was 4 feet of air and an unknown water depth. I mean, immediately went over your head, right? So when those guys started the survey, three of them went upstream into the unknown with just their wetsuits. I think they had Swagos. They didn't have life jackets, which they should have, but they just went swimming. And when you take off swimming, it's probably 500 or 600 feet until you can stand up.
Wow.
And touch the bottom. But it's only anywhere from 6 to probably 15 feet wide, just depending. And of course, it's a river, so it's winding all over the place. But they started getting hit in the leg and in the chest. And they're, you know, not just like a love tap by a small fish, but like, you know, getting drilled by a big fish. And they're like, what in the hell is this? So eventually they get to a point where, you know, they can see, oh, with the water clarity, there are fish in here that are, no joke, 2 to 3 feet long, and they were everywhere.
Wow.
And that's how survey went. So now I'm brand new to caving, and you got canoeing into a cave and wetsuits and low air and swimming and heavily decorated, and we're mapping into the unknown, and there's these fish that every time you're in a contained pool, they got nowhere to go. So they if you touch one, they just freak out. I mean, you know how it is. If you go see a fish at a pond and you try to poke it with a stick, they take off. Well, yeah. They can't go anywhere in the cave. So that's how survey was. When we were surveying all these crawlways and lower air places, you're just constantly getting drilled with a fish. And the further upstream we went, the more fish there were. And eventually we found, you know, a pit entrance to the cave, because we were getting 2.5 hours upstream from the historic entrance. And we thought, wow, this is really remote, which it's not, obviously. There was way more remote caves than just 2.5 hours in. But, you know, we found a pit entrance that I ended up pushing a crawlway at the bottom and ended up connecting it to a trunk line that was the main river just further upstream. And sure enough, there was a catfish swimming around that was huge. And it's like, this is the cave. We just connected another entrance, right? And when we finally found what was to be the upper entrance to the cave, basically what's going on is you got an 80-acre sinkhole pond, right, that's stocked with fish, and its natural overflow when it flows during the rain flows down a dry creek bed and right into another sinkhole. Well, that sinkhole is the entrance, the upper entrance to the Black Fathom River Cave. And it's not a fun entrance. It's 200 feet of belly crawling in a wetsuit. And of course, there's no water because why would there be? And so finally, when you do get to the water, you're overheating. You're like, oh, thank God, get it, get me to cool down. But then you're in a channel that's, a foot and a half wide, 2 feet deep of water, and there's fish.
Oh God.
And they can't go anywhere, and you got to swim through it, and they're just beating your ass. And eventually you keep following this downstream again, pools of fish. And you eventually get to this place that we called Orca's Last Stand. And I have pictures and video of it on my Facebook page, but it was a pool of water that was probably 15 feet around. And it just looked like a seining pond where it was just 30 or 50 or 60 huge fish just swimming around, bumping into each other, and they had nowhere to go. And then you jump in the water with them and chaos ensued, of course. Which, now the unfortunate part about all that is the owner of that lake has since fenced up multiple layers of wire fencing where that overflow is to keep the fish from washing out of their pond. Because you'd go down to the farmer's field where the cave entrance is, and of course that cave eventually it can't take all the water on, so it starts filling up and spilling over the county highway, and there's fish just flopping around all over the place. And so every time it would rain heavy, they would lose hundreds and hundreds of fish, and they were catfish, grass carp, big mouth buffalo, just all big fat dudes, But now you get in there and you're lucky to see one or two, maybe 15, 16 inches long, a bunch of smaller ones. But yeah, the days of that chaotic, just fish just knocking you senseless, those days are over for now. But we did at least shoot a lot of video of that back in the day, even though it's crappy video. This is like pre-GoPro, but it's video nonetheless. And it really was fun. So yeah, that probably all those combinations. And it's like, this is 15 minutes from my house. How can you not get hooked on that? Plus nobody knew where we were going. It was all completely new cave. The thing about it is where Perry County is, where all the big caves are, where Rimstone and Mystery and Brome and Crevice Cave, everybody from St. Louis would come down 61 and just go right to Perry County because that's where all the big caves were. They would drive right through St. Genevieve, right past Black Fathom, and nobody ever even took a look at anything there. And then 2007 rolls around and boom, 7 Mile Cave, brand new discovery in Missouri. Between that one and the Gegg Cave on the other side of the interstate, those two big caves, that's 12 miles of new survey in between the two caves. That those are like the two largest cave discoveries in a generation in Missouri. And everybody from St. Louis used to just drive right past them. So good for us, but yeah, it hooked me big time. And I haven't, whatever hobbies I used to have, which were many, kind of all fell by the wayside.
So we've talked about some incidents.
Mm-hmm.
What about accidents? Has anything ever gone south?
Not really to me. Although I did, we found a pit. We found like a tag multi-drop.
Wow.
In St. Genevieve County a few years ago.
Is that unusual?
Very unusual. Pits like, so we have a pit entrance to Black Fathom right now. That's 110 foot rappel. It's not the biggest pit in the world, but the rope at least free hangs, so you don't have to use pads. We got the ceiling bolted. We found other pits in the area that were right around 100 feet deep, upwards to 115 to 125 total ceiling height, right? But they're all kind of small. But in this one spot in St. Genevieve County, there was a known cave that was found. It ended up bottoming out around 200 feet deep, and that's what Black Fathom. Black Fathom is about 212 feet deep from the upper lake entrance to the sump. So having a 200 foot deep cave in St. Genevieve County is not unheard of, but going 200 feet deep just instantly, that's not something we usually find. Well, my buddy Alex Litch, he lives about 15 minutes from me. I actually met him caving during the Missouri convention in 2015. He was still a college student at the time, right? So he comes around and we got to know each other. Well, now he works in St. Genevieve County, probably took a job there because of all the caves that, you know, we were discovering back then. And, you know, he got a lead on a pit. And I went over there with him and we walk up on it. And it's, I don't know, the opening of it at the top is probably 60 feet across, you know, huge. But it immediately choked down to something that was like probably 6 feet in diameter. But when you walk upon it, it's just this massive pit, right? Like something more like Kegel's Chasm or Valhalla down in Tag, right? Just huge entrance. But it chokes down quick. You can't see that until you're on rope. And that was like a 90 or a 92 foot drop. And I went in first, but there was a tree that was growing right on the edge of the pit. And when that happens, you know, it's always easy to rig to a bigger tree in the back, rig high on that one, so you can just rappel straight down the wall and there's no lip crossing, right? Well, we were doing a bolt climb in there one day and, you know, I was frogging out with all the gear and that tree uprooted and fell over.
Oh my God.
While I was on rope. Yeah. And, you know, to back up a little bit, that cave ended up going 200 feet deep with five rappels, probably within 200 feet of horizontal. So it just went down and down and down and down. You know, I remember we had to keep coming back out of the truck or out of the cave to get more rope from the vehicle because that just doesn't happen in Missouri. You take one rope.
Right.
Well, we had to end up taking four ropes in there that day. But anyway, so I'm climbing out and I'm probably 50 or 60 feet up this 90 foot pit entrance. And all of a sudden the rope shudders. And I instantly dropped, it had to be 5 to 6 feet, but it sure seemed like a lot further. But, you know, what happened was the tree uprooted and fell over and spanned the pit. And since I had rigged up about 5 feet high, maybe 6 feet high, so that's where the drop came in. But it was kind of it wasn't like an instant drop. It was however long it took for the tree to fall over. And the whole treetop broke off and come crashing down. And missed me because it was some big, you know, it would have impaled me on rope. It would have been a bad day. And then I look up and, of course, now I see the tree spanning the whole pit with the rope just out in the middle of outer space. It's like, oh, my God. And, of course, it was scary as hell. And I ended up climbing up and had to get off. And, of course, the two guys that were with me, Alex was one of them. You know, he's like, are you okay? I'm like, yeah, the tree just broke. I mean, literally. So that it was a major anchor failure, but it was back tied to a much larger tree. That was a close call. I thought I'd bought the farm when I started dropping, you know, it was scary, very scary. And at the end of the day, you know, I pulled the rope up, re-rigged it so they could get out safely and not be, you know, climbing, because now you got the tree that the rope was back tied to coming down to the tree that fell in the pit. And that rope was guitar string tight. I mean, it was stretched so tight, you know, it took a while to even get the tensionless hitch untied because of how tight it locked everything together. I mean, I remember it. It wasn't just a quick unclip the carabiner and unwrap the rope, because I usually tuck the tail behind all the wraps just to keep the tail out of the way. And it had that thing locked into the tree so tight. It's like, what do? You know, I guess we could cut the rope, but it wasn't my rope, you know? And then of course the anchor that was tied to the tree that night was locked. I mean, it was just, yeah, it was wild. It you know, learning experience, it was like, okay, don't, maybe I shouldn't rig those trees on the edge, but if you're going to, they always got to be back tied. But you know, who would have thought that a hickory 10 to 15 inches in diameter would have just fell over, but it did.
Was it dead? Was it alive?
It was dead. If I remember right, it was like around fall. It's been a while.
So it'd be hard to tell.
It was hard to tell. But once it crashed down, of course, the bark started falling off and it was like, you got to be kidding me. So, you know, so yeah, it at the end of the day, once we got everything done, we kicked the log into the pit because it was a liability spanning this entire, you know, pit entrance. But, you know, there was a, I think that's probably, other than that and the flooding where the water was, you know, fire hydrating into the cave, you know, most of the trips we've been pretty lucky, but man, it was, I think it's coming upon 12 years now. December, I think it was December 3rd or December 4th of 2010. It's in the ACA. You can look the story up. But I was in the longest cave in Illinois, and these guys from the Near Normal Grotto were always hounding me. Hey, you need to come to, you know, check out Fogle Pull Cave with us. And that's the longest cave in Illinois. There's 8 or 9 entrances. The main Fogle Pull entrance is on DNR property. And all the other entrances are on private property. So, and they had permission to go to a couple of those private entrances. So, you know, we were in there, and for whatever reason, I don't remember, but they were like, those guys aren't surveyors, but they're still explorers nonetheless. And they were trying to find all of the entrances to the cave from the inside out, you know, based on the map. And I followed them one day to this passage that had very low air. And yeah, whatever. Black Fathom has low air. It doesn't have, like, you know, inch low air, but it has low air nonetheless. I think 2.5 inches at the most, but even then it's a very brief amount, and then it pops back up again, you know, so nothing crazy. But we're going along in this cave, and I don't know, 6 to 8 inches of air, 2 feet of water. So you're kind of creeping along, and it's like, well, this isn't bad. They're calling this very low air. Well, then it shut down to an inch to 2 inches tall. It's like, okay, that's very low air. And I looked in it, and I kind of took my helmet off, and I went into it like 5 or 10 feet, and you could feel the airflow just rushing past you. It's like, yeah, there's an entrance up there, but somebody's already done this. I don't need to do it. The map shows it goes to another entrance, you know, and I'm as far up there as you could see. It was 1 to 2 inches of air. I'm like, I ain't doing this. So I backed out. Well, my buddy, he went into it, and he's like, I'm going to push it. It's like, okay, whatever. But he had a neoprene hood on, and I didn't. So, of course, I get into, you know, low air like that and all the water. You know what? It's just colder because your head gets cold, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, honestly, at the end of the day, that might have been why I backed out. I don't remember, but I didn't like it. Well, he went into it, and he went into it probably 70 or 80 feet.
Wow.
And, of course, if you panic in an inch or two of air, and I'm pretty sure it was about an inch and a half where he was, you panic, you're screwed. Well, I don't know what happened. He doesn't know what happened, but he got like a mouthful of water, and, of course, choking, and panic ensued, right? And we're all hanging back, and we're like trying to look, you know how it is. When the ceiling and the water are an inch or two apart, you can't see anything unless your eyeballs are, you know, right in the water, and you could see light flailing and disappearing, and you could hear splashing, and it's like, I wonder what the hell he's doing up there. Well, he was drowning, you know, and he was in full panic mode, but he could see our headlights. He remembers that. So yeah, spoiler, he obviously lives through this, but he could see our lights. So he was trying to make his way, and man, it seemed like an eternity, you know. And then all of a sudden it was just dead silent. And it's like, where the hell did he get through? You know, is he in walking? Of course, we're yelling, hey, where are you at? And then like the ceiling, as I remember, was a very gradual elliptical tube. So, you know, when the walls and the water meet, it's not like a wall. It's just the ceiling just kind of nosedives down in. And I saw his green and blue cave suit just barely, you know, wedged into the wall. And he was floating at the ceiling, and it's like, oh, he just drowned. And he was maybe 10 feet in, because it went from like 6 inches of air to an inch and a half of air, you know, instantly. And I'm like, oh, my God, he's there. And when I'm doing wet caving, I've always got a long tether on my Swago just so it can float on my side and I can drag it, because Black Fathom has miles of crawling. You know, everything around where I do have its miles of crawling. And if you're going to cave with a Swago, just drag it, right? Well, I got tangled up in that drag line because I just, you know, you're just sitting there and the pack's just floating around wherever. And now I'm trying to get to him, and I had to back out and get this line, untwist it around me and get it off and get rid of the pack. And I, the other two guys, they were like in full, just deer in the headlights look. And I yelled at one of them, like, you got to get Todd, you know, you got to get in there and get him out. So he just like dove into the water and disappeared, literally just disappeared. And it's like, what in the hell just happened? Because now you've got one guy that's drowned and another guy who just dove into who knows where and is gone. And so now it's me and this other guy. And I finally got, it turned into a shit show real quick. And so I got my Swago untangled and I went in there and I was able to finally get to the point where I could grab him and I drug him out. And as I got to the point where the ceiling popped back up to six, 8 inches tall, whatever it was, the other guy popped up out of the water, smacked his head off the ceiling, of course, because, you know, when you're in those super low air spaces, you can't wear a helmet. Ooh, right?
Ouch.
Well, the problem with that is, of course, when he did all that, of course, he dropped his helmet. And of course, Todd, who drowned, had long since lost his helmet, right? He dropped it during panic mode. And so I got him and I, you know, started dragging him back to where the ceiling gradually opened up to, I think it was a foot, maybe a foot and a half of air. I have it all detailed. Like I wrote a trip report that was, you know, a book length because it mentally trying to process what happened, you know, I had to write. So anyway, the details are better kept there than in my head now, but I drug him back. Man, it seems like I drug him for like 500 feet, but there's no way because again, this happened so quick, but it seemed like time slowed down to a screeching halt. And, drug him up to where the water was shallow enough that I could get his head and neck over my leg. And I'm cramped up in it. So the passenger was probably 2.5-3 feet tall, started CPR. Well, I hadn't had CPR since college. I don't remember anything. And of course the other guys were now accounted for and I'm yelling at them to get over here. Cause I don't know what I'm doing. You know, I didn't know what I was doing, but I was doing mouth to mouth. I was doing compressions. And of course his eyes are just glazed over, wide open, staring at, you know, nothing. Mm. And you know, he was gone. And after, again, it seemed like forever. He started breathing again and he came back and we, you know, we drug him over to a mud bank and got him, you know, out of the water as high as we could. And then finally he came around, he understood what happened. And we were like, geez, now we got to get out of here. Cause we were 2.5 hours in and about 15 minutes of it was through this horrible mud crawl that who knows how deep the mud was, but it was one of those deals where I was first through. So the mud was firm, but the second person, it was like quicksand. It would get looser. And then the third person. So now we're trying to do a self-rescue through all this crap, you know, the whole time he's just hacking up brown phlegm or whatever. Cause you know, we've all seen so many movies where people drown and they resuscitate them and water just comes gushing out and you know, they're coughing. Well, none of that happened. And I don't know why, but I think he talked to a doctor later and when your body senses you're drowning, it will collapse your esophagus shut so that you can't drown, if that makes any sense. At least that's what I remember. And again, this was 12 years ago. But he still obviously had something in him because where's this brown crap coming from, right?
Yeah. So,
you know, he's spitting it up and we're making our way out and we get to a point where we're at an entrance where we can get him out. But the entrance we came into was further up and a hell of a lot more crawling, right? And it was a pit entrance, but you could climb it healthy and not half drowned. So he made the decision, we've got to go up out of the pit because I cannot do any more crawling. I just can't do it. So, you know, I went up, rigged a rope, tied a bunch of probably butterfly knots or inline figure eights. I forget, but just a ton of handholds. And we got him out that way. But it was like shoving him up and pulling him up. And then, you know, now we're I don't know, half mile from the vehicle. And, of course, I had to run and get my truck. And I'm running, literally running down this county road in a wetsuit, in a cave suit, dragging my cave pack. I mean, man, I was exhausted. And I had to fly to New York the next day for work.
Yeah.
You know, and anyway, so they get out. We get out of the cave. And I'm like, guys, I got to get home to pack. Because, again, you know, I was still having a problem processing what had just happened, because again, he was gone and now he's back and he is in really bad shape. So they took him to the hospital and they hook you up to something where they can measure your, the oxygen ratio, that your oxygen saturation level, which is, for us, like right now, is usually in the 90 percentile, and his was in the 40s.
Wow.
So he was in trouble. You know, he was in trouble. So he stayed, I think he stayed in the hospital for a couple days, but he drove back to Bloomington where he, because he works at a hospital. So he wanted to be in his hospital if he's going to get care, not in St. Louis. So yeah, we still go caving to this day. I mean, he's been a little accident prone over the years. Like we were at a cave in Tag and we were hiking off the mountain after a pit bounce and he slipped on a flat slab of rock and broke his freaking leg. You know, not his femur, but his lower, the tibia or the fibia. And he hiked off the mountain with a broken leg, jumped in his truck and drove home.
Oh my God. You know?
Yeah. Another time we were in Rumbling Falls. We were in the Rumble Room and, you know, there's just breakdown everywhere there. Well, he lost his footing and did a cartwheel, two cartwheels down the breakdown and landed. And we're all like up under the rope getting ready to climb out, because this is before it was a through trip. And he comes limping in and he's like, guys, I got to get out of here. I just fell. I'm kind of hurting. And I'm like, oh, whatever. It's Todd. He's always in a rush to get out of there. Right. Very impatient. and at the time I had just had shoulder surgery on my left shoulder, but they'd planned this trip and I'd never been to the Rumble Room. So I'm like, I don't care what it takes. If I have to crawl with one arm, I'm getting to the Rumble Room. And I got there and I mean, I could crawl a little bit, but you know, it's definitely one of those trips where looking back, I probably shouldn't have went, but it wasn't that big of a deal. And so he's hurting and I'm like, well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to be slow getting out anyway, because I'm doing everything with one arm. I'll just go with you. So we get out of the cave and, you know, climb the ropes, get out, go back to the truck, and he takes his shirt off and it's just road rash. Horrible all the way down his side. And it's like, dude, I thought you were just like being impatient. You wanted to leave. So you're like, guys, I'm cold. I'm hurt. I kind of slipped. I want to get out of the cave. Right. No, he was bad. And then come to find out, my buddy actually had his GoPro going when he fell. And you can literally see him doing cartwheels down the breakdown of the Rumble.
Gosh,
like, dude, you know,
it's amazing. Something worse didn't happen.
I know. Well, all three times, right? Yeah. You know, it's like, dude, no, we need to quit caving together, because every time we cave together, you get hurt and I have to rescue you. So, but you know, that was the worst incident. And again, you know, it was a tough time.
Yeah.
Like my 2 week trip to New York lasted, I think, 4 days. I had to come home. I just,
yeah.
You know, I was having trouble processing what the hell happened. And, you know, now we can look back on it and joke about it and, you know, I can talk about it and it's not an issue. But at the time it was just like, what in the hell? How? I never thought I'd be in that position, you know, to whoever would have thought. So after that, you know, I hear stories about people, you know, nonchalantly and jokingly pushing low air. And I'm like, you know, you guys need to be careful, because you can get in trouble. And, you know, and the worst part about all that is, if you're in a situation where somebody is having problem in low air, you can't help them until they're either out of it or they drown. Because if you go in, you're just going to get pulled in too.
Yeah.
And you know, that's obviously not something that I thought about at the time, but reflecting back on it, you know, that's the only thing I can say about it, is that's what happens. You can't help them. And they either have to help themselves or you have to wait until they're done. And then you do what you can after that. So, yeah. Other than that, I mean, we've been pretty lucky. I mean, you know, there's never been a full blown rescue in Missouri in the past 14 years since I've been around. I mean, sure, there's been, you know, twisted ankles and maybe a broken hand. Actually, I do know of a broken hand. I was on that trip, but that was, you know, slip, you hit your hand on the rock. You're like, okay, my hand hurts. We got to leave. I was involved in that rescue in Arkansas 5 years ago, New Year's Day, Chili Bowl, when that gal from Texas fell and like dislocated her shoulder and she was 4 hours in and it was a pit and it was a, you know, there were people coming in from all over the place for that one, you know, but I wasn't on that trip. I just kind of showed up to help.
Yeah.
You know, luckily I've missed the tag trips where friends were down there while other people got hurt in other caves, like that big sinking cove rescue. What was that? 10, 11, 12 years ago, the guy fell and broke his femur. Well, all my buddies were down there. They were caving and they had to help with that extraction, bringing that guy back up out of sinking cove. And I actually just did a trip there during the cave-in and was pointing out to all the new people. I'm like, yeah, see these bolts here? This is all from that rescue. Everything you're going through, they had to bring this guy up through the top, and they couldn't even believe it. I'm like, you know, every time I do that trip, I'm like, yeah, I can't believe it either, you know, that they could get somebody out. But luckily, we don't have rescues in Missouri, thank God, because, you know, we don't have the manpower that they do in Tennessee. It'd be people coming from Tennessee and Indiana and Arkansas if it was a really bad incident, you know. And that, I guess that's, at the end of the day, that's kind of what we're going over this weekend with the OCR in Perry County.
Yeah. Cool. Well, we're at an hour. I want to be respectful of your time. Is there anything else you want to hit?
I think that kind of covers some of the finer points of kind of how I got started and why I do what I do. I mean, it is kind of funny. You know, my kids are involved in the Boy Scouts. So every time I go there, the one parent in particular is always like, so how'd you try to kill yourself this week? Well, I was at Bridge Day, you know, and I saw the guy eat the parachute and spiral out of control in the water, but I was on the climbing rope. I'm good.
I saw that. I didn't catch the end of that. What happened there?
So I was on the 450-foot climbing ropes when that happened. And so have you been to Bridge Day?
No, I haven't, but I've been invited a million times and I've never gotten to go.
Right. So huge bridge, and they're all jumping off right in the center where the river is, because that's where they've got 876 feet down to the river level, right? And then the rappel ropes start literally ropes one and two land on the rocks right on the edge of the water.
Yeah.
And then ropes three and four, those are all, that's an 851 foot rappel. Then the elevation jumps up to the railroad level and you've got six or eight rope stations there that are all 801 feet. And then from there, the valley starts going up, you know, the gorge, and the rappels are now 750, 700, 680 or whatever they all are. Well, the climbing ropes this year, or all previous years, were around 700 feet tall. And for this year, for some reason, they put them all the way at the end where there's a 450 foot climb almost next to the actual road that goes down in the gorge. Basically, you're rappelling, or you're climbing from an old service road that has long since been shut down, but it's a nice climb. So those ropes were maybe 600 or 700 feet from the river. And even when you're at ground level, you're already 400 feet above the river. And I was another 200 feet up the rope, and out of the corner of my eye, because you know how it is when you start climbing on rope, eventually you stop spinning and you're facing whatever direction, and you don't move after that. You just climb. And I could see it out of the corner of my eye. I could see this spiral. I'm like, what the hell is that? I'm trying to grab one of the other climbing ropes because they're all clumped together. And if I could just grab one, I could turn and see it. But I could see the guy spiraling and he ate the water. And I heard that, you know, I heard him eating the water. And I got on the radios to my team. I'm like, did you guys see that guy in the parachute? He just ate the water. Oh, my God. But the strange thing about it, like all the boats, and, you know, they didn't immediately go into like high gear, like a fatality would have happened. Right. So I finally got hands on a climbing rope, and then I turned my GoPro on. I'm like, oh my God, I just saw this guy. He ate the water. And, you know, and I'm waiting for the ambulance to come, and the ambulance never comes. Well, I finish my climb, I get up the catwalk, and I run into the facilitator for all the rappellers. You know, I'm like, man, did you just see that guy? He's like, yeah, it was a guy landed on another guy, collapsed his chute, but they scooped him up. He grabbed his parachute. They took him to the boat dock just like they do everybody else. And he jumped out with his arm full of parachute and took off. I'm like, oh.
So he was okay. Oh, my God.
He was okay. You know?
And that looked bad. You know,
yeah. I mean, 11 years ago was my first Bridge Day. And I was on the safety team from 2011 to 2019. And this is the first Bridge Day we've had since 2019, but it's also the first Bridge Day I've ever done where I actually paid and then I could do whatever I wanted. every other time it was safety team. I'm there making sure nobody screws up. Well, that first bridge dad just rappelled off the bridge for the first time, and I had my back turned to the river. I was talking to two friends, and there's a video out there of this happening, but this guy jumped off the bridge with one of those wingsuits, and I guess he thought he was going to catch air. And what I learned is it takes a lot more than 876 feet of free fall to catch air in a wingsuit and start going horizontal. And that dude, he deployed his chute under the tree line and he ate the river and he ended up in a wheelchair. You know, and he came back a few years later and apparently jumped off with the wheelchair and he landed on the pavement at the boat dock in the wheelchair and rolled through the landing. So at the end of the day, he lived, but it's like, my God, you know, that this year was the closest call since that one in 2011 when the guy, he hit the water. I mean, hard, really hard. And it was weird. You know, the danger for the rappellers at Bridge Day are the parachutes that get blown into the rappel ropes.
Yeah.
And so far we've never had a chute collapse, at least in the 11 years that I've been there. And I'm not so sure there actually ever has been. And there are photos of parachutes hitting those ropes and the tips of the parachutes come in and they're like touching before they roll off and open back up. But if I remember right, and I may have the name wrong, but Jeff Martin, who used to own Intermountain Outfitters with his wife, Nina, I think it was him. He was on rope rappelling one year. And the chute hit above him and the deflection was something like 50 to 100 feet where he got taken for a pendulum swing because of the parachute striking. And I think it was Jeff Martin, if I remember right. But yeah, other than that, you know, it's just another event, not necessarily a caving event, but you know, Bruce Smith, I met him years ago and he asked, hey, you want to get on the Bridge Day safety team? And it just so happened 2011 was Bruce Smith's last year doing it. You know, and he stepped down after that. But yeah, it's a rappeller's event. It's not a caving event, but if you like long rappels and long climbs, it's definitely pretty cool.
I gotta go. No worries. And do it. One of these days I'll make it over there.
Yeah. I mean, you got the high hanging Hoosiers are right out of Indiana. Yeah, Dean Wise.
Man,
you
know, Dean invites me all the time and I just never commit to it. Yeah.
This year, our rope was right next to the high hanging Hoosiers. So I was hanging out with him and Lee, which we did LCAP together, and Robbie. And I can't remember who else was on the team, but I've known those guys now for years because we've done so much, you know, well, Bridge Day so many times that, you know, yeah, great group of people. We should go hang out with them sometime.
Yeah, indeed. Well, Chad, man, this was a pleasure. I really appreciate it. And great storytelling. Thanks for hanging out for a little bit, man.
Yeah, no worries. Thanks for having me.
Wow. That drowning story, man. Be careful. Wouldn't want anything like that to happen to you or anybody for that matter. And really appreciate Chad sharing that. He didn't have to do that. And thank you for listening. This is a monthly podcast. I'll be back on, New Year's Day with a fresh interview with Mickey Manning. Mickey Manning is the first guest of 2023, and I hope you'll be here for it. Big thanks to our sponsors, past and present, Swago at swagogear.com. Thanks for the Swago shout out, Chad. Organic Robot Designs, get your t-shirts made for your grotto, raise a little grotto money and get them made with Charlie. He's our current grotto chairman at the Central Indiana Grotto, and he's got a brick-and-mortar t-shirt shop in Greenfield, Indiana, and at organicrobotdesigns.com. El Spelio, get one of the best lights on the planet for caving, currently being sold by On Rope One. And, of course, our current sponsor, Sophie Reaptress, custom cave suits. Click the link in the description of this podcast and order yours however you want it. And I think that's all I got. I hope I get to go caving soon, or really anything. I hope I can get out of this daggone house. I am standing in my newly designed office right now, which is really nice. I built a new desk. I'm standing. I'm not sitting anymore. At the old cheap desk, I built this thing out of galvanized pipe and 2x4s and pre-finished shelving from Menards. It was great. I feel awesome. I'm dancing around in here now. This is fantastic. If you follow me on Instagram at Matt Pelser Radio, you'll take the little mini tour, if you care. All right, I'll see you next month. Until next time, kill nothing but time.